Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
The Steve Austin Show is sponsored in part this week by WWE 2K18. The biggest video game franchise in WWE history is back with WWE 2K18. Featuring cover superstar Seth Rollins, WWE 2K18 promises to bring you closer to the ring than ever before with hard-hitting action, new game modes including the addition of 8-man matches, deep creation capabilities, a new grapple carry system, and thousands of new animations and a massive backstage area. Plus, WWE 2K18 features a brand new rendering engine that also gives the franchise a visual overhaul, bringing the drama of WWE to life like never before. Pre-order the deluxe edition to play 4 days early and get two playable versions of WWE Hall of Famer and current Raw General Manager Kurt Angle, along with the WWE 2K18 Season Pass, the Cena Nuff Edition digital content, and more. Also, be sure to check out the official WWE 2K18 in-game soundtrack, personally curated by executive producer Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Available now on Apple Music. To learn more about WWE 2K18, head on over to WWE.2K.com and pre-order today. Be like no one.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm sitting at my house over here at 317 Gimmick Street with a microphone in my hand and a laptop computer on my table. Today is Monday as I record the opening of this podcast, and it is trash day. And I've had to close the doors, the windows, batten down the hatches because Monday is trash day in this neck of the woods in my part of the neighborhood in Los Angeles. And three trash trucks coming by to get the green stuff, the recyclable stuff, and the trash has been absolutely discombobulating. Holy smokes, I can't even get my train of thought. But I got to get my train of thought together because I got to do a good open for my buddy. Scott Levy is my guest today on the podcast. He's got a brand new podcast himself. It's on podcastone.com, just like mine, a free download on iTunes. He's under the Jericho Network as a part of Podcast One. It's called The Raven Effect. Let me read a little quote about his show. It says, "Join professional wrestling superstar and world-class idiot Raven, along with a motley assortment of friends, enemies, know-it-alls, know-nothings, professional-level morons, and highly functioning sociopaths for a veritable cornucopia of stupidity covering current events, conspiracies, pop culture, politics, general muckety-muck, and any and all topics that can be properly bantered." Tell you what, I got a chance to listen to his live podcast, which he did over here, what was it, the Hollywood Improv, something like that. Him and his buddy Busby just get on Skype for most of the episodes, and they just start shooting a breeze, talking back and forth and going over things. And I listened to part of the live podcast they did over in Hollywood, some funny stuff. And man, I tell you what, I've had a lot of laughs with Scott Levy. He was one of our travel partners, him, myself, and the late, great Flying Brian Pillman in our WCW days. We called ourselves the Comedy Trio, always plagued by bad service at all the restaurants that we stopped at. We used to travel around in a Chevy Lumina van, and I would never let Raven drive because he was a horrible wheel man. I didn't like when Brian drove either because Brian drove too fast. A lot of times Brian would drive, but I preferred driving. But man, I got a lot of laughs with this guy, and known him forever. Happy that he started doing a podcast, and he's under the Jericho Network on Podcast One. It's also a free download on iTunes. Give him a 5-star rating, send him some feedback, and it was good seeing him again, man. Scott went through some dark times, had a few demons back in the day, and he's overcome all that. He came all the way out here to California, and I got a call from my old producer. And said, "Hey, man, Raven's coming in town. You want to have him on the podcast?" And I said, "Well, hell yeah, I want to have him on the podcast." So he came by 316 Gimmick Street and over here to 317. And, man, we got a chance to catch up and visit, chew the fat, laugh our heads off. And it's good to see him. He's in a real good place right now. He's got a good podcast. I highly suggest you give it a listen, give him some feedback on it. You can catch it. It drops every single Monday under the Jericho Network on Podcast One. I tell you what, got a good podcast for you today. I'm talking to Raven, and before I get to Raven, tell you guys a little story. Y'all know when I sold the Broken Skull Ranch about 6, 7, 8 months ago, however long it's been, I'm looking for another place. And could end up being in Texas, could be in Nevada, could be, man, I don't know yet. It probably could be anywhere. But a while back, we had looked at a property in Nevada and, almost put an offer on it, but just couldn't quite pull the trigger on it. And we've been looking around ever since and hadn't seen anything really pop up that kind of grabbed our attention. So I said, you know what? Let me get back on a computer, see if I can find that property again. And I found it, and it wasn't on the market anymore, but it was still for sale. So I got in touch with my real estate agent and said, hey, man, is there any way we can get back in and look at that property? You know, I was kind of looking at it again, and maybe it will work for what we're looking for. So he called me back, and he goes, hey, man, yeah, they'll show it to us. Come on down. I won't be in town, but my partner can show you around the place. I said, that's cool, because I know what it's all about anyway. So me and my illustrious wife, Krista, we loaded up the GMC Yukon XL Denali with the 6.2 liter 420 horsepower motor. Put our dogs, Callie and Moolah, in the back. Had that whole thing laid out flat and headed down to Nevada to look at a potential ranch. I'll tell you what, man, that damn Yukon got so much room in it. Me and my wife, it was only an overnight trip. Distance is about 420 miles. We had a little bitty-ass suitcase. Damn near looked like a lunchbox. A couple pairs of underwear and a couple pairs of socks in there. We was just going for an overnight stay. So anyway, man, 420 miles, it was an easy drive. Well, y'all know me. Most time, I'm hauling ass. Everything flies by because I'm usually driving about 90. But just like that last trip we made out there to Mammoth Lakes, I was taking my time and enjoying the drive. And that ain't a bad drive to make. 420 miles, pretty easy to do. So whether you're hauling ass or driving a fixed speed limit, you're basically going to get there in about the same time. So why risk life and limb? Nice, leisurely drive. Stopped by that sandwich shop in Bishop. Got a pastrami sandwich. It was cheat day. Went over, looked at the property, and then we went out to eat at the restaurant. And had a glass of whiskey, had a glass of Woodford Reserve and a Sculpin IPA because I didn't have Broken Skull IPA because we don't sell it in Nevada. It was a damn good beer, and that's a damn good whiskey. We went back to the hotel room. And we went back to the hotel room. We had thrown our stuff in a room, and it seems like every single time we go to Nevada, there's some kind of function. Last time we tried to find a place, well, we canceled that trip. The Hot Air Balloon Festival was statewide or whatever it was. Couldn't find a damn room nowhere. This time it was the air show. The Blue Angels was flying around when we got there. We were watching them in the distance. Every damn hotel room in the entire area was sold out. Finally, we found a room and it was a double. Two queen-size beds. Now, I don't think you're supposed to smoke in a hotel. It wasn't really a non-smoking room. It's supposed to be a no-smoking hotel. We opened the door to that place, and I was happy to have a hotel room. But I'll tell you what, it was a little on the rough side and had a distinct odor in the air about it and those two double beds. It was funny. When we started relaxing and getting ready for bed, we each had our own bed. Now, you say, Steve, you could have both slept in a queen-size bed. Yeah, we could have. But we sleep in a king-size bed every single night, so sleeping apart in a queen-size bed, I can handle it. We're only 4 feet away from each other. I'll tell you what, man. I was sitting there sipping on a glass of whiskey because it was my cheat day, just trying to wind down, and everybody's in town for the air show. Got a nice, quaint, quiet room going on, and boy, I tell you what, someone must have said, ready, set, go. Because all of a sudden, somebody let the kids loose. And they was running 50-yard dashes, 100-yard dashes, 200 meters, stop and goes, jumping up and down, cartwheels, tumbling. I thought the damn ceiling, their floor, was going to cave in. We was on the first floor. They was on the second floor. Holy smokes. I told my wife, I said, if I hadn't had a couple of drinks, I'd just soon get in the damn Yukon and drive over to the next town and get another hotel. But I wasn't going to get behind the wheel. I wasn't messed up. But I probably had a little bit of a buzz, and that ain't worth risking. But them damn kids was so loud and it was raising so much hell, and I was wondering. Because if my kids would have been 4 to 6, 8, 10 years old, however old they was running up and around that hotel, well, my parents would have lit my ass up. So I'm over there listening to all that damn stuff. I thought about going into the bathroom, getting some toilet paper, wadding it up and putting it in my damn ears. But then I said, you know what, Steve? If you drink another glass of whiskey, you'll go to sleep, and then you'll get on the road at 5 a.m., and then you'll be home. So that's what we did. To sum it up, 420 miles there, 420 miles back, looked at the property. You know, could it be the Broken Skull Ranch 2.0? I don't know. I don't think so. Don't think we found it yet, but the journey continues. We're still looking. I think I'm going to head down to Texas in a day or two and go down and visit my folks. Take a look down there and visit with some friends of mine. We have been trying to get down to the great state of Texas for about 6 months. Every time we think about going, something pops up. But right now, I told my wife earlier today, I said, you know what? I'm feeling Texas. I'm thinking we're leaving in 3 to 4 days. And we'll load up the dogs, and I'm going with you or without you, but we got to go. Well, of course, my wife, she's ready to go down to Texas, too. I wasn't drawing a hard land in the sand. I was just trying to be a tough guy on a podcast. Anyway, looks like we'll maybe head down there for a couple of days, see everybody, stop by, and see a friend who works on hot rod cars down there, maybe do a podcast with him. Graduated Edna High School with him. He was the center of the football team. Weighed about $165, $185. I was a running back, weighed 205. North and south runner, wasn't fast enough to run east or west. Anyway, looking forward to getting down there to Texas to seeing my family, my mom and dad, and some friends. Hey man, before I get to Scott Levy, the Raven of the Raven Effect Podcast under the Jericho Network on Podcast One, my guest today, I want to tell you guys, man, the ratings have been awesome for Broken Skull Challenge. I appreciate everybody tuning in. Make sure you put your TV, set your DVR this Tuesday night tonight, if you listen to the podcast today. When you download this thing, make sure you got your DVR set on CMT, Tuesdays, 10, 9 Central, only on CMT. This will be the third episode, and things start ramping up from here on out. Got some new challenges we're throwing at you. The Skull Busters, new design. And it's just total badassness, and it's only on CMT every single Tuesday at 10, 9 Central. Set your DVRs. Make sure you don't miss the toughest show on television. My buddy, Scott Levy, the Raven, is coming up. But first, let me give a shout-out to Dollar Shave Club for changing the game. By now, you're probably aware that Dollar Shave Club ships amazing razors for just a few bucks. Well, what you might not know is that Dollar Shave Club also has products for all your grooming needs, from body wash to shampoo to hair gel. And in fact, they have so many of the essentials you need that you won't need to leave the house to get all this stuff. Dollar Shave Club's got it all. Dollar Shave Club makes it absolutely simple to upgrade your shave and your bathroom with their high-quality products delivered right to your front door. For a limited time, new members get the Dollar Shave Club starter set for only $5. In your first box, you'll get trial-size versions of their shave butter, body wash, butt wipes, and their executive razor with an awesome, weighty handle and a full cassette of cartridges, again, for just $5. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically for just a few bucks a month. You can only get this offer exclusively at dollarshaveclub.com/Steve. That's dollarshaveclub.com/Steve.
Hi there, my name is Susie Schuster.
And I'm Rich Eisen.
We're teaming up once again in the studio with our new podcast, Not Just Sports, with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen.
So we're sportscasters and we're parents, so we're just going to be hanging out, talking sports and other stuff.
And I will try to educate you on all things in the NFL because,
Thank you, of course,
behind every great man is a greater woman.
That's correct.
There you go.
Join us every Wednesday exclusively on Podcast One Sports.
Subscribe today if you know it's good for you on Apple Podcasts or at podcastone.com or download it on the new Podcast One app.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
I just pushed the record button. Sitting across the table at 317 Gimmick Street. Scott Levy. Raven.
How you doing, man?
Host of the podcast, The Raven Effect. My old travel partner, longtime friend. God dang, it's good to see you.
Good to see you, man.
Hey, I got a word that you were coming to Los Angeles, California, as we record this podcast. I think it's October 6th.
Yeah,
So you had a gig. No, it's October 5th.
October 5th, yeah.
So you had a little gig in town. You're doing a little bit of
yeah, we got
stuff.
We got me and Busby, my sidekick on my podcast, Raven Effect, shameless plug.
We got to plug the Raven Effect. It's on the Jericho Network at Podcast One, and you drop a show every single Monday.
Yep, every Monday. And so we're doing a live one tonight at the Improv in Los Angeles. So hopefully at least 8 people will show up, so we have somebody to clap.
God, hey, how many people does a comedy club seat?
Thousands, millions, maybe 60.
No, of course you.
60.
60.
Yeah.
So how is it going back in front of a crowd? Because this takes it back to, you know, our younger days in the business when we were first starting out. And, you know, sometimes, dude, you're wrestling in front of nobody.
Yeah.
Out of the nerves. And what's the transition?
My record, I think, was 13 people. When I was wrestling in for Florida Championship Wrestling in Lakeland in Tiger Town, hangar number 2. We didn't even rate hangar number 1. We got hangar number 2.
Is that a shoot?
That's a shoot. 13 people. But like, as I moved through the career, I got better and better. And then, and I learned more how to behave in front of, you know, eventually you just, when crowds are that small, you just ask them what they want to see. Oh, what do you want to see? And the guy in the front row goes, I want to see a suplex. Oh, here's a suplex for you.
Give guy Iggy suplex coming your way.
and you
put it twice, give it to me.
You put all the audience on one side so they're all piled up. And then if you want to call spots, you just turn your back to them.
So, but the gig is tonight.
Yeah, the gig is tonight.
Let me ask you something. I'd love to go, but I hate to get out on the main streets of Los Angeles, especially down there in Hollywood at nighttime. Traffic is absolutely just berserk, and we're hauling ass to make a long-distance trip tomorrow morning early, but we're going to leave about 5 a.m. When you do a live podcast at the comedy place like you're doing, I know you're Busby. He's a comedian.
Yeah.
Funny guy, and you are too.
Yeah, I do some stand-up, but I'm so lazy that I don't do much of it. Like, you know, I'll do like 8 gigs a year. You know, it's just plenty.
I want to talk about your laziness in a minute because it's in part of your write-up on your website. What we all do? Are y'all just going to just call us, sing in a ring?
Yeah.
Make an ad lib?
Well, that's what we do at the show. Like, our podcast is basically, if you've never heard it, which probably you haven't because...
I haven't heard my own podcast,
no,
dude.
No, I don't mean you. I mean the audience listening because you got like 1 million listeners and we have much, much less. So 90% of your audience hasn't heard my podcast, but basically, it's like me and you are doing right now. We just start talking, and whatever comes up, comes up.
So you got any kind of format, or you just roll in there, and it's a straight-up shoot, dude?
Well, yeah. I mean, like, well, we might have an 8-second production meeting, which is me texting him saying, what do you want to talk about? And he'll say, I saw something on Raw that, you know, because we're trying to make it more wrestling adjacent. You know, because we don't it's so loosely wrestling-based. The idea that it's a wrestling podcast is not the strongest title for it. It's more just a platform for me and him to talk nonsensically and just banter back and forth. But so he'll say, like, I saw an angle because I don't watch wrestling anymore because I got too divorced from it. It broke my heart too much. You know, it's like, it's a cruel mistress. But so he'll suggest something. I'm like, that's fine with me. That's the end of the production meeting, you know. And then the show starts out with the slide whistle. That's the opening of the show. And then I'll do some ridiculous rant, like an introduction. Like I'll talk about my dog, who's also the executive producer of the show. and my fire-breathing pet goat, who really doesn't exist, but I think he might in my mind. And I'll talk about what they're up to, and then I'll introduce my co-host with some rhyming nonsense. Like, it'll be something like, he has a picture of the great Gama. He filleted a llama. He once said, yo, what's up, Holmes, to Obama. And it'll be like 5 minutes of just nonsense like that. And then we start the show. And sometimes we do news items, like there's a news item that I was going to probably do tonight talking about this. It says there's a mad pooper in town and some lady's taking like poops in people's yards and just dropping them and then traveling on. And every day she does it somewhere different. It's a mad
That's
pooper.
That's here in L.A.
Oh, is that where it is?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the mad pooper. And so, you know, and then for a while we are on the head transplant. Did you hear about that? There's the guy supposed to get a head transplant. Like they're going to. Yeah. So Busby's completely in disbelief. He's like, there's no way that they could keep the guy alive. And I'm like, they're going to do it. It's going to happen. And so then we go, so we have news items. We have fan mail, which is always preposterous. And then we give recommendations. But mostly the body of the show is just me and him just chatting about, you know, like either, you know, the whether it's the UFC, whatever happened that week, or wrestling, or whatever. It's really just a vehicle for us to talk like me and you are just talking now, you know, and just to, you know, shoot the breeze.
But let me ask you a question. Somewhere along that rant, you said you kind of became divorced from the business of professional wrestling, dare I say sports entertainment.
Yes.
So how did you lose your way with the business, or how did the business lose its way from you?
It's, you know, it's to be absolutely honest, it broke my heart when I was in WWE and they didn't use me to my fullest, or even to half my fullest, or even a quarter of my fullest. And to finally, you know, get some, to make a name for yourself, you know, I've just been, you know, I got 30 years in now, but that's, you know, 15, 20 years ago. I was at my peak. I just come off ECW and WCW, and then went to WWE, and they just mistreated me left and right. And it just broke my heart. And I'm like, and then what compounded it was the wrestling had got so bad. I mean, you know, it had gotten, other than, you know, maybe one angle on the show, the rest of the show was just junk, and the booking was bad, and it just wasn't fun to watch. And then there started to be really good television. Like, there didn't used to be great shows. I mean, maybe Three's Company might be considered a top 10 show. I mean, now it wouldn't even make the muster. So I just started watching more TV, and next thing I know, I was just not watching wrestling anymore. And that was about 2000. And I really, you know, it's like if I'm at a gym and it's on, I'll watch it. You know, I'll watch a match or two. If I'm at a pay-per-view because somebody pays me to fly in and be a celebrity guest at a pay-per-view, I'll watch it. But I won't put it on my TV. I won't watch it. I don't flip channels because I DVR everything. So I just don't come across it that much. But I keep up with it because it is what I do. It is my, you know, even because I still do
but
indies.
But how do you keep up with it?
I read one of the sheets, you know, basically.
Jesus Christ.
I read one of the sheets. Somebody sends me some information. I got a buddy who sends me, like, the highlights of what happened. You know, I'll skim through the sheets. You know, it's like an hour worth of reading I'll do in, like, 8 minutes, you know, because I don't really care enough. But I still want to know what's going on. And then that breaks my heart even more, like, when you read stuff like, you know, when they put all the heat, you know, on Triple H and Stephanie, and they just emasculate the talent. I'm like, well, how do you expect them to draw? You know, how is anybody going to draw that way? And so it's just, she's a cruel mistress, the wrestling business. You know that. I mean, you were in your prime and you got dropped on your head, career over. I mean, it's a brutal mistress.
It works that way sometimes. I was able to land on my feet after many years of doing a lot of stupid things. And so here I am sitting in the house talking with you on a podcast. If you were to watch, if I was put on TV right now, could you just watch and say, okay, and watch the story that's being told in the ring? Or
yeah.
Are you going to nitpick everything?
Yeah, no.
Because you can watch as a guy who did it
right.
Basically for 30 years or, you know, your active years. But you can also just put your hands back and say, okay, I'm going to enjoy this and not try to look at it as a guy who did it forever. How do you watch the business if you were to watch the business?
I do watch indie matches when I'm on indie shows. Like, I don't watch a lot of them. Like, you know, we used to watch all the matches, you know. But now, you know, I'll read a book in the back, you know, or I'll, you know, schmooze somebody, you know, or just chit chat. But, you know, I'll watch a match or two. And I used to be hypercritical when I was in it. I mean, you know, I alienated more people by giving advice and saying, this is what you should have done.
You were famous for that.
Yeah, I was famous for being a dick.
But I always enjoyed hearing your opinion.
Yeah. Well, it's like some people either love me or you hate me. There's not a lot of middle ground to it. But now I'm less critical, I think, because I've less invested in it. That's the best way to say it.
How are you feeling physically?
Physically, I feel fine, but my interior health isn't bad. I have a sleep disorder that's just brutal. I wake up like every... I don't want to get into it, and woe's me, because I had a great career. I made a lot of money.
But tell me a little bit about the sleep disorder, because I don't sleep worth a damn myself. I got sleep apnea. I got the CPAP machine. I tell all of my listeners that if you're a little bit overweight or you got some nose problems or whatever, go get your checkup. So I've been wearing a sleep apnea mask for 8 or 10 years. But I just on top of that, dude, I wake up 3, 4, 5 times a night. So, and I'm only in bed for like 6 hours. I don't sleep worth a damn.
Yeah. So what I wake up after, like basically everybody over 35 wakes up after every sleep cycle, but most people aren't aware of it. They just roll over, go back to bed. I wake up bolt upright, and this will happen anywhere from 10 to 30 times a night.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. So that's why I never get a full night's sleep. And so a lot of times there's days where I'm not getting out of bed, you know, other than to watch TV, you know. But here's the thing. It's my own damn fault, because if I wouldn't have done so many damn drugs and screwed up my system, I wouldn't be in this position. So I hate to glorify drug use, but, man, I had some crazy adventures. But we always give at the end of the show an 800 number for addiction help, because, let's face it, if I could go back and do it again, if I got regrets, but, you know, everybody who says they don't have regrets is full of crap, but if I could go back and do it again, I would cut out half my adventures for better health now. So, I mean, you know, I wanted to be elegantly wasted. That was my goal, so to speak. But, you know, I made it come true way too much.
Yeah, but, you know, just in my own deal, man, I was the alcohol guy. And I would say to anybody, you know, with retrospect or hindsight being 2020, or now the fact that I'm 52 and I'm looking back at my bulletproof years, you know, 20 through, you know, 40.
Yeah.
You know, it was, dude, Katie bar the door. I say everything in moderation. I would cut back.
Yeah. And, oh, my God. I would have done things differently. But I couldn't, because I had so many emotional, you know, problems. You know, because I couldn't, you know, let's face it. I think everybody should have to visit a psychologist at least a couple times, you know, in their lifetime, just to get to see what's going on underneath the hood. You know, it's like you take your car to the shop, you know, take yourself to the shop, get a look under the hood. The Raven character was a manifestation of my inside stuff, like what's going on in my head. But anybody who knows me, like, I'm a ridiculous, goofy bastard, you know, so if you knew me, it was like, wait a minute, that's not you, Raven. But it really is, because the people who really knew me knew inside that's where Raven was. But unfortunately, so art imitated life. But then eventually what happened was my life started to imitate art, and I started to do a little more drugs and a little more alcohol, because that's what Raven was. And I wanted to be true to him, even though he was really just based on me to begin with. So, and next thing, it spirals and spirals. I bet you can relate to that.
But you worked yourself into a shoot.
Yeah. Did it happen to you a little bit?
Yeah. Not in the form of the Stone Cold persona, but it was almost like I always said when I hit the ring or whatever, that was me turned up to an 11.
Right.
So, yeah, I would kind of say then being dialed up from my normal one or two.
Well, no. I mean, but, like, after, when you get out of the ring, did Stone Cold start infecting Steve Williams, I guess? Did he start infecting you, and where you started to drink a little more because Stone Cold would?
No, not because Stone Cold would, because Steve Williams would. Yeah, and that wasn't a life imitating art. That was just me. Yeah, I like to drink.
Yeah.
You know, I still like to drink. I just drink a lot less. But right. So it wasn't a case of that. But let me ask you a question. If you don't mind talking a little bit about drugs.
I don't mind that. I'm wide open.
Dude, I remember I was in a car in Dallas, Texas. I won't mention the name of the person I was with. I was riding shotgun.
Eric Embry.
Personal. You get two more guesses.
Anyway, Skandar Akbar.
No, it wasn't.
Gary Hart.
No, it wasn't him.
All right.
So anyway, we're riding down the road to Oklahoma. It's one of my first shots. And the person looks over at me and says, hey, man, you want a Vike?
Right.
I'm like, what?
Yeah.
He said, you want a Vike? I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, it's a pain pill. I said, well, what for?
I was same way. Yeah.
Give you a bus. Dude, this is after playing college football. I'm 23, 24 years old.
Think you've been around the block?
Dude, I ain't never seen a pain pill. I'm Tylenol or Excedrin or whatever. Right. And I said, well, you know, what do you say? You're on the spot. Well, sure.
Yeah.
So I took the bike. I'm riding to Oklahoma. Maybe I got a little bit of a buzz from it. It's like 750 milligrams. No big deal.
Right.
But anyway, through the course of your career,
yeah,
then you kind of get, you know, the lay of the land. Everything is introduced to you because, one, it's like the sporting business. I consider myself a professional athlete while doing it. But also, we were rock stars while we were doing it.
I always say that.
And then we were also truck drivers because we was driving ourselves up and down.
Never thought of that one, but yeah, that's a good one too.
Dude.
Yeah.
So, and then so with all the gym stuff, with the traveling, the rock star stuff, dude, all of a sudden, dude, I went from just coming from born in Austin, Texas, grew up down there in Victoria and Edna, Texas, a population 5,000 people, all of a sudden, man, I'm in the wrestling business, and everybody's kayfabing me in the beginning because I'm the Jay Brone, I'm the green guy. Jay's smarting him up.
Right.
Hey, dude, what about a pain pill? And all of a sudden, you see a little bit of this, you see a little bit of that, and all of a sudden, you're doing a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Right.
And it could turn into a whole lot for a whole lot of gas.
Yeah.
You would consider yourself, at one time, dude, a hardcore addict, right?
Yeah.
So I was able to stay in the vein or that zone that I was in, which is a medium zone.
Right.
Alcohol was high.
Right.
So what spun up for you?
It just, my tolerance, I found something I was really good at.
To that point, I would say that a parallel with the drinking.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, the reason I used to be so egotistical was because I was insecure, you know, so it was all trying to mask that I was insecure inside, and here I found something I was really good at, taking pills, you know, what a stupid skill, but that was my skill set.
We're laughing, but you and me are longtime friends.
Right.
It's not funny, but it is funny.
It is funny, but that's why I always give the 800 number for the addiction hotline because it's funny now, but you know, anyway, back to my first time seeing like drugs in the business. I was wrestling in a first territory. I'm in Memphis, we're in a spot show, and it's me, Jimmy Jack Funk, and Max Payne, I think. Or I'm not sure, but I know it was me and Jimmy Jack Funk against Billy Travis and two others. And so we're in the corner, me and Jesse Barr and Jimmy Jack Funk. And he's like, when I get the chin lock on Billy Travis, I'm going to shove two Placidils in his mouth. I'm like, what? He's like, and I knew what Placidils were because I'd heard about them like the week before, you know, but which they were like old timey drugs, like, you know, barbiturates or Seconals or, you know, stuff they don't make anymore. And so he goes, and I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm thinking, so he grabs Travis, puts him in a chin lock, and then he just covers his mouth and forces him to take the Placidils. And then, of course, little do I know that Billy Travis was probably ecstatic that he was getting two free Placidils. You know, so I went from being, oh, my God, I hope nobody does that to me, to 5 years later going, I wish somebody would do that to me.
Hey, Jimmy Jack, can you call the same spot for me?
And get it again.
Billy Joe Travis, you mentioned a couple of names. I want to get back on the drugs in a second. Billy Joe Travis, kind of a, God rest his soul, he's no longer with us, but he was like a poor man's honky-tonk man. That dude could work his ass off.
He was an amazing
worker. Billy
Joe
Travis was a hell of a worker.
Unbelievable.
He taught me a lot.
Yeah, unbelievable worker. I mean, he is probably one of the best workers that nobody's ever heard of.
Yep.
I mean, not the nobody.
Tremendous heel. I mean, he could also work great babyface, but I loved him as a heel. Great in the ring.
Great punches. He had that punch where when he'd throw a punch, instead of slapping his chest, he would snap his arm like a root, like he have his arm would be bent at the elbow, and like a rooster, he would pop it against his flabby side chest, and it would make a big pop sound. And it was brilliant. And it, like a lot of guys try to throw that punch where they slap their chest, but it's so obvious.
Yeah.
Or they miss completely. The punch is just way off target, hitting the nose and the ear. But he was right on target with every punch, like a Bobby Eaton, except he did it by snapping his elbow down like a rooster.
But another guy who was also a guy that I watched have a lot of great babyface matches against Matt Barn. We're going to end up in Portland territory here in a minute. But God dang, Jimmy Jack Funk could work his ass off too.
Yeah.
He was another guy that helped me out a lot with advice on the road, dude. White meat baby face, green as grass. He gave me a whole lot of advice. Really helpful.
First, so I had like 7 matches before I got to Memphis. I had 7 or 9. I can't remember exactly. It's either 7 or 9. And
because that's a vast amount of difference in experience on your resume.
Yeah. So it's either 7 or 9. So I get to Memphis and
definitely wasn't 8.
That wasn't 8, but it was 7 or 9. So I get to Memphis, and so they call me in the room, Jerry Lawler and Jerry Jarrett, and Jerry Jarrett's, you know, spitting his tobacco, and I'm just shaking like a leaf, you know, and they go, what's your finish? And I'm like, what? I didn't think I was going to be going over. I'm like, a clothesline? Which is pathetic as it is. It's not quite that pathetic because it wasn't used in 6 times a match back then. It was only used, you know, it was sparingly, but it was still pathetic. And they go, we have somebody who does that. I go, off the second.
You didn't.
I was on the spot, man. I was so nervous. So then they had me go out there and they gave me 4 minutes with Keith Eric. Remember him? Jobber?
Yes.
Yeah, so 4 minutes. After two minutes, I'd forgotten every move I ever learned in the business.
Yep.
You know, because I only had 7 to 9 matches. And so I hit him with the finish. 1, 2, 3. I get to the back. They go, you went a little short. I go, oh, I'm sorry about that. You know, just trying to play it cool. That night, we went back to Nashville, and they had me wrestle Jimmy Jack Funk for a 10-minute Broadway. And so we're wrestling, and he's got a wrist lock. He starts squeezing my wrist. I'm like, why is he squeezing my wrist? Nobody taught me. You know, I didn't know any of this. I didn't know Carney. I didn't know how to, I didn't know, you know, Larry Sharp didn't teach me, you know, he wasn't even there when I learned, because I went to Sharp's Monster Factory. Charlie Fulton, the old hand, was there. So he trained me, but he didn't smart me up to much of anything, you know, other than, how to do it. And so he's squeezing my wrist, And then third time he does it, I'm like, maybe he wants me to reverse it. So I reverse it. He looks at me like, yeah. I'm like, oh, I got this business now. So,
boy, you're on your way to become general.
On my way. And so he carries me through 10 minutes after only having 7 to 9 matches. And we get done. And then he sets up a thing where, so he has it timed, so as they're going 10 seconds left, 3, 5 seconds left, at 2 seconds left, like top him, he has me on top from 1, 2, but 3, but their time runs out. They thought I was great. Oh man, they're like, oh, what a match, man, you're great. And we had done this, we didn't talk at all before the match, you know, cause opposite corners,
yeah.
You know, so I had no idea. I'm just, you know, I think he's going to beat me up or something before the match. I don't know what is going to happen. I never met the guy, you know, and then I ended up riding with him for a while. While we were both in the territory, but so they thought, oh wow, this kid's good. You know, maybe he went home early on TV today, but you know, he's going good. And then, the next night it was me. Remember Ricky Nelson?
Yeah.
So me and Ricky Nelson, it was me. Yeah.
Work.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I don't think it was, it might've been his first territory too, but so they put us against these guys, the Zebra Warriors, who are like 5'7". They got masks on with a Spartan Trojan kind of hair thing sticking out, you know, yeah, down the back, you know, from the top to the front to the back, like a Trojan helmet. And so they were there. It's their first territory. We stunk the joint out so bad. It's got to be one of the worst matches in the history of the business. I mean, they're just like, oh, my God, you're terrible. And the next week I was doing jobs.
Did the where was that? Was that down in Tennessee?
Yeah.
Did Jerry or anybody back in the day? Because you remember when WCW run, Grizz would come to the ring and he'd start waving that tie.
Right,
he was
right.
Stinking out the joint and he was killing the town.
Oh no, they let you stink out the joint there.
Yeah, God dang.
That's how you separate the wheat from the chaff.
I worked at Lebanon, Tennessee. I just came into Tennessee territory.
I remember the name. I have no idea where that is.
Dutch Mantel, just right outside of Memphis, if I'm not mistaken. But anyway, it's just a small town, Spacho. And maybe it was out of Nashville. I don't remember. Dutch Mantel was a booker. When I came in, he didn't even know I was coming into the territory. He gave me my name, all that whole story. Everybody's heard that a million times. And he said, well, hell, you know, he puts me out there. I'm working with, I think it was, it might have been Doug Gilbert's father.
Tommy Gilbert.
Tommy Gilbert.
Yeah.
He was wearing a hood.
Right.
He says, go out there with Tommy. You'll go about 10 minutes. And I think, I can't even remember who went over in the match. That's how long ago it was. But I just remember Dutch Mantel. I'm green, dude. I've been in the business for 2 months.
Right.
And my first match, they're in the Sportatorium. I'm wrestling Frogman LeBlanc.
What
similar
a name.
Situation. All of a sudden, I'll get back to Lebanon in just a second. So there we are in the Sportatorium. Chris figures it's time for my first match. I've been training for 2 months, basically doing a little bit of chain wrestling, taking some bumps. You
right.
know the routine.
Right.
I didn't know nothing. So we go into the office upstairs at the Sportatorium. Of course, I'd never been there.
Right.
And we're talking about what's
and you had to be in
this match.
You had to be in awe at that point, right?
Dude, I'm still thinking this is a halfway shoot because in 5 months he hadn't smartened us up none.
Really?
No, dude, zero. Oh
wow.
And so, you know, prior to that, I was playing football at North Texas State. Me and my buddies drive up to Sportatorium. We're getting drunk, throwing stuff at the wrestlers. You know, the standard what you do, right?
Right.
And so I'm thinking, he gives me the elbow. He's looking at Kerry. He goes, come on, man, you're as big as he was. You need to go ahead and get in this. So anyway, I got into Chris Adams Wrestling School. There we are. We're about to have my first match. And he goes, Steve, I'm not going to even fake the British accent. You're going to win with the flying clothesline. stupid ass flying clothesline, not even off the second like yours was. So you were a high flyer right off the get go.
I was a medium flyer.
Dude, we go out there and this is a television match for KTVT. I mean, it's like live to tape.
Wow.
I'm out there working with Frogman LeBlanc. He's got this thick Cajun, you know, accent.
Yeah, how did you understand him?
Well, we just kind of were going off of what Chris told us. Tony Falk was a referee. He's you know, he's trying to call us some high spots.
Right.
I must have hit Frogman with about 10 clotheslines that match, and then finally the fly and one at the end.
That's when it did it.
Yeah, for that.
It was
finish.
Tony Falk going, "Humana, humana." Dude, I'm old Tony Falk from Paducah, Kentucky.
You know, here's the thing. Tony Falk could work his ass off.
Yes.
I love Tony Falk.
He was amazing.
He was a referee. He didn't get a great run in the business, but God dang, he could work his ass off. But going back to the 10-minute Broadway, I mean, think about how ludicrous that is.
Yeah.
The 10-minute Broadway.
Yeah.
Because they can put the 10-minute time limit on the match, and then neither guy can beat each other in 10 minutes. And so you've got all these, you know, this buildup
right.
to the false finishes. But when you think about it, sounds easy as hell. It ain't.
No.
It might be after you got a couple years in the business, but if you're green as grass.
Yeah.
Because, like, dude, I used to do a bunch of 10 or 15-minute Broadways. And when Matt Bourne was working with Jimmy Jack Funk and they were doing 15-minute babyface Broadways, that would be the best match on the card
of course.
That night.
Of course.
But when you think about building it, you think 10-minute Broadway, because you always think about Flair, the 60-minute man.
Right,
because almost every single night, the real world champion was going 60-minute Broadway. So when it's minimized to 10 minutes, you kind of feel like a J-Bro in retrospect.
Yeah. Well, I gotta interject. I got to do my Tony Falk impression. Humana, I'm old Tony Falk from Paducah, Kentucky. I had my first match. I was dressed up like a girl. They made me tuck my wee-wee through my back of my legs, and I put on a woman's outfit. I put a mask on, and I had my first match as a girl. You know that? Have you ever heard that story?
I've never heard that story.
No, it's me and Brian Christopher used to, every day we would, whenever we'd see each other at a building, as soon as we saw each other, we'd walk up and we'd go to shake hands, and then we'd stop before we did, and then we'd look at the non-existent people, and I'm like, come on, shake my hand. And he's like, should I? And talking to nobody, there's nobody there except me and him. He's like, you know, we could be in a mall. And he's like, should I do it? I'm like, come on, it's okay. And then finally we shake hands and start doing Tony Falk impressions. And I guess Tony Falk's first match, they had him dress up as a girl and under a hood and do a match as a girl. But he goes, I had to stick my wee-wee, I had to stick it back through my legs. Because he had that Paducah, Kentucky accent. It was amazing.
But the dude could work his ass off.
Amazing work. And he actually drew money for Jarrett in Memphis. As he was doing that Boy Tony character.
How long did you work for Jarrett?
I worked for him like three months the first time. Then I came back after being Scotty Flamingo. And I was back for, I don't know how long, but it was like the Hotel California. You could check out, but you can't ever leave.
Yeah, but you went to, was that pre or post Portland?
First place I went was Memphis. Was there for 3 months. Went to Florida for 10 months. Then went to Portland. And actually, I went to Vancouver for Al Tomko for a month. But then I got run out of that country. And then I went to Portland, which is where I learned how to work. And I was there for 2 years.
Who was the guy that helped you out in Portland? Because remember, when you left Portland, I was going to be the guy that was going to take your spot.
Oh, were you?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Sandy Bart. No, I said, man, right now we've got a guy, Scotty the Body, because that's what you're working
under. Right.
He goes, man, he's a great bumping heel. We see you kind of being in a similar vein. And so I was going to come in on your heel steps on your way out.
But you got brought into WCW.
I got the call.
Really?
So I never ended up going to Portland, but I'd heard so much
I
about
I never
the
knew that.
Oh, yeah, straight up.
Wow. Yeah, it was the Grappler, man. I've had him on my show. I don't have a lot of guests on. I mean, maybe once a month, because I try to – me and Busby have such a good rapport, but the Grappler I wanted to have on because – he's another guy that's names lost in the past, who's one of the greatest workers. Like, just there's so much I learned from him. I mean, you know, it was like an honor to be able to tell him, you know, how much it meant to me at this point, you know, now that I'm older and he knows I'm not, you know, BSing him, you know, because everybody's right. BSing everybody in this business, you know, and to be able to tell him how much he meant to me and how much I learned from him. But my favorite thing that he ever said, though, was I go, he wanted me to drive down, because I always had to drive because I was a green kid, you know, so I used to ride with him. He's like, all right, you drive, kid. But at least I get to drive his truck, so I didn't put the miles on my car. And so we had to go to Coos Bay, and it's like 220 miles. This is a horrible trip. And because Portland had all the short trips, so 220 was like a long, long trip. And he goes, "You drive there, kid. I'll drive on the way back." So we're getting ready to leave, man. I'm exhausted, you know. And I'm getting ready to get in the car. He goes, "You just get us out of town, and then I'll take over." So we start driving. We get about 10 minutes. He goes, "Listen, if you get tired, pull over, get out of the car, put my mask on, and let the grappler drive."
That's ridiculous.
Is that great? Put my mask on and let the grappler drive.
I always heard, I didn't get a chance to see a lot of that guy's work.
Amazing.
But I heard it was awesome.
You would, if you watched like now, you could watch his stuff from Portland now, like, you know, from 1990, and you would just be like, wow, why didn't that guy get a break? You know what I mean?
Well, why didn't he?
Well, it's funny. He did. He, when he was his first year in a business, or his, no, maybe his third, fourth year in a business, he's 5'10 and 240, and he's working on top for Watts. And you know Watts was all about the big guys. So, I mean, to put the guy that young, that green, and that small, you know, for him, and short on top, man, that says a lot. I mean, and so basically long story short is he was working on top with the dog. And then one day he got, it's not for me to say, but I mean, it's in his book, but basically he, thought he should get equal pay to the dog, not realizing that the dog's been on top because the dog was a money machine.
And absolutely.
He was just a license to print money in Watts' territory. And, you know, he wanted to save money. And basically, Watts said, forget it. So he goes, well, I'm walking in. He goes, well, there's a door. Watts calls up Ole, convinces Ole to bring so Ole calls up Lenny, the grappler, and says, I'll bring you in. I'll give you this much, and then starved him out. Because, you know, because Watts made the call.
Right.
And Lenny and the grappler, Lenny's his real name. Everybody thinks it's Len Denton, L-E-N, but it's really Lynn, girl's name. And so Lenny just, then he had to rebuild his career from scratch, and he never really got back to the top of the game. You know, it just didn't work for him. Even though he was an amazing worker, could make anyone look good, could go just one of those guys that you were just watching. It was like Barry Windham. He glided. I mean, Dustin Rhodes is like that too. They glide. It's like they're on ice or something. And that's how he was. And he just so funny. Like, he taught me how to be funny, you know, how to tell jokes in a ring. And, you know, that it's not, you know, I'm like, wait, you can be funny? You can actually have a good time wrestling? It's not just I got to, you know, woo the crowd or do that, but I can actually, you know, be loose and light. You know, and you know, it was a whole new experience. I mean, everything. I learned everything from.
Yeah, but I didn't learn that you could actually have a good time in a ring until several years into my WCW run.
Right, right.
And it's kind of like, man, you know, as soon as your entrance music hit, I'm kind of in a different zone. All of a sudden, the bell rings, you're locking up. But I'm serious as a heart attack, trying to have the best match of my life right then, right there, at that time. Trying to have a good time wasn't even part of the equation.
No.
I'm trying to have a good match.
Right.
And then it might have been when I started working with Barry. That guy, you know, I don't want to say he took me under his wing, but Barry and I wrestled a whole bunch on television, and we never really hung out together. I made a couple of trips with him and Pee Wee when he was still alive. But Barry Windham might have been the guy that really kind of smartened me up. Hey, kid, you know, you can have fun out
right.
here. And all of a sudden, man, when I kind of got smartened up and I worked with a couple of other veterans that let me know, dude, what you're doing is serious. You're trying to draw money. You're trying to tell a story. You're trying to get people to hate you. You're trying to get that baby face
right.
over, make them love him and, you know, get them mad because you're beating him up and flip-flop and fly for the comeback. But in the process, you can have fun.
Right.
And when all of a sudden I got smartened up to that, it just gave me a whole different level to my matches because it brought me a little bit of relaxation and peace within myself. It was like, hey, dude, if you're having fun, they're having fun.
Yeah.
If you're sticking to whatever thought process you got in your head and you're not free thinking or enjoying yourself, you're screwing yourself.
You don't have the same poise.
Correct.
You don't have the same grace. Which is a word you don't hear in wrestling, but you just don't have that same looseness, that ability to think on your feet. You know, like, if I didn't know I could have fun in a business, like, well, I remember one time I was in England and I was working with Alex Shane. I don't know if you know him or not, but mm-hmm. he's a British guy. And so he's the champion. So they hand me the belt to look at it. and I was a baby face. And so I seen this kid in the crowd. The kid's got to be 5 years old, the cutest kid I've ever seen. And so I, all right, you know what? I'm going to go put the belt on the kid. So I go roll out the ring, put the belt on the kid, you know, because the ref handed it to me to look at. So I go put on the kid. So I tell the ref to tell Alex, go get the belt. So he goes, of course, the ref, instead of meandering over there, he just walks in a beeline diagonal straight towards him, whispers in his ear, puts his hand to his mouth and whispers in his ear. You know, because there's
right. Hey, go get the belt.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Or instead of just circling the ring, like, okay, yeah, we're starting a match, and then just kind of, you know, on the back out of the corner of his mouth, because there's referee psychology too, you know? And so he goes out there, gets the belt from the kid, gives it back, gets in the ring, gives it to the ref. I take it from the ref. I give it back to the kid. He goes, now he's smart now. So he just goes right back out, takes the belt from the kid. Let me back it up. So the first time I give it to the kid, big, yay!
Hey, you're the hero.
He takes the belt from the kid. Boo! Oh, they hated him. I mean, without that part of the story, doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're booing the crap out of him. He gives it to the ref. Let's start this match. I take it again, give it back to the kid. Yay! The kid's so happy, you know. He comes back out, boo, he takes the belt. So ref gives it to the ref. I take it again, third time's a charm. Jesus. I give it to him. He comes around to take it from the kid. I jump off, boom, soppy doll in the back of the head. We're off to the races.
Why is it always in three?
It's just the rhythm. It's the rhythm.
You got to set the hook.
Yeah.
And then every now and then someone says, okay, let's go for five.
Five's too many.
You kill them.
Yeah. You're right.
And you can't do it on four. It's an even number.
But no, that's a
great. Seven to nine matches.
Yeah, 7-9 matches. But no, but you said it right. You set the hook. You set the hook. Then you got to let the bait wiggle, which is the second time. And then you can pull the shit out from under them.
Right. All right, Scotty, let's take a quick pause for the calls and get big ups to TrueCar. Now, there's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know. The TrueCar can also help you find a used car. In fact, there are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. Whether you're looking to buy new or used, TrueCar gets you upfront pricing information that empowers, letting you see what other people paid for the car you want so you can know what a fair price is and feel confident. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing to make the process quick and easy. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. And while we're on the subject of cars, let's figure out how you can save hundreds of dollars on car insurance for that vehicle. All you have to do is go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. You can finish listening to this podcast and immediately after go to GEICO.com and get yourself set up. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
What's happening, guys? This is Chael Sonnen, America's favorite gangster. Make sure you check out my show, You're Welcome, right here at Podcast One. I've got guests like Stone Cold Steve Austin, Dana White, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and upcoming Brad Pitt and Will Smith are going to be in studio to talk about upcoming projects. Go, listen, enjoy, check it out. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Send a pigeon, send a fax, write it on a postage stamp. Just make sure you are listening to Your Welcome at Podcast One, or download and listen on the Podcast One app.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
How fast or quickly in the business did you gravitate towards the psychology?
Pretty quick, I'd say. Like, Memphis, I kind of started to, like, after about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you know, after I had made that horrendous match with the Zebra Warriors, after like 4 weeks.
The Zebra Warriors, I mean, WWE's got a trademark. Yeah, can I smell money?
Yeah, go money ahead. In the bank.
Yeah.
So.
Zebra Warriors.
Zebra Warriors.
Go for it. So we're talking about psychology, but here's the thing. So all of a sudden, I'm about to start working with Chris, okay?
Right, right.
Before I get you back into your psychology.
How was his psychology?
Oh, dude, awesome.
That's what I thought.
Awesome. Chris is a great storyteller. And here's the thing. That dude was a smart, shrewd businessman. And Chris had his demons, as many people in life do. And so when it came down to the business, though, dude, when it came time for him to get a win, he got a win.
Right.
It was time for me to get the heat back. I got the heat back, and he was running our program. Embry had the book. Embry would okay everything. Jarrett was okay with everything, but Chris was booking our stuff.
Right.
And so he was a smart businessman, and he carried me through every match because I was green as grass.
Right.
I did my thing, but you know, I was lucky to have him as a trainer to put me in those high-profile matches, which helped me win the 90 Rookie of the Year.
Because,
dude, other than that, if I'd have been in a high-profile match, I wouldn't have got the exposure. I wouldn't have won nothing.
Right.
Okay, to a degree, it's a work, but nonetheless, he was fantastic. But one time he handed me a piece of paper just like this on my desk right here. It was a legal pad. He goes, Steve, here's the basic formula of a match. And he basically wrote out, you know, I'll paraphrase this. I have it somewhere here in this house in a briefcase, an aluminum briefcase.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was basically babyface shine.
Sure.
Heel heat. Babyface comeback.
And finish.
And finish. Either A, you know, babyface goes over or heel slips on a banana and baby goes over. You know, something to that. But he goes manic comeback. So he laid out like 5 points of a basic fishbone psychology for me.
Wait, before we get off of Chris Adams, I heard his super kick was stiff as hell.
Dude, he never stiffed me with that thing. But then again, I was 24, 25. I was so
You wouldn't even have known.
I was so damn tough from playing football at North Texas and, you know, and still in macho mode.
Right.
You know, towards the end of your career, or you always fancy yourself as being a pretty tough guy. But you want to work with people that aren't going to kill you.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and if anybody says any different, I know there's the tough guys in the business. I like it. And I was snug.
Right.
I was snug. And I like being...
But you were safe.
Yeah, I was snug and safe.
Right.
And so I like the same in return. One of my favorite guys, and I didn't get a chance to work with him very much, only a few times, Ricky Morton.
Oh, my goodness.
And Bobby Eaton.
Right.
Those are guys. And, of course, Flair is Flair. He's my favorite.
Bobby Eaton was like a wrestling savant.
Bobby Eaton, if you look at the way he incorporated a second rope on some of his high spots or just falling back into a feed, phenomenal.
Yeah.
But to me, to watch those guys, their style, it was the clean pro style.
Yeah.
Everything was crisp. Everything looked good.
But Brad Armstrong.
Brad Armstrong. But when you watched, it looked like a pro style. The presentation was, you know, everything looked good. The gaps were tight. Things that didn't look like they were just crushing you. It looked like what, you know, you would put on pro wrestling is.
Hey, let me interject for real quick. The show I was at the other night in Jersey. No, in, was it Jersey? Yeah, I don't know. It was Jersey. And Manny Fernandez was on the card, and he was wrestling Homicide. Man, Manny Fernandez, first of all, how the hell he can move like that at 60-something is ridiculous, but he made it, he still looks so believable. And he did some little things like, you know, like Homicide's trying to lock up with him, and he just slaps the hand away. Like, what are you doing? I'm running this show, you know, like his character, not him, really. But just, I was like, wow. I was like, man, to be able to, like, that realistic looking wrestling disappeared a long time ago.
It did. But then back to the psychology, when were you able to stray from your basic formula into the multi-layered storytelling of a long time period match?
Portland. I mean, I wrestled literally, people always say literally, but literally 6 nights a week. There might have been maybe three weeks a year that you wrestled five, but they were made up by like 3 weeks where you were seven days. So it was 6 days a week. Then there were battle royal months where you had to wrestle twice. You know, you got your match and a battle royal. Or then there's the show where somebody doesn't show up. So then you got to wrestle two times and a battle royal. So you're putting in 330, you know, you got to have 350 matches in a year. I mean, and like I tell guys, you know, when they go, I'm working indie guys. I'm like, how long you been working? He goes, 10 years. I go, well, how many matches you had? He goes, 150, 200. I'm like, then you've been working 2 years.
Right.
Like now, because of the way the business is, 100 matches I'll give you as a year, you know, but back then 300 matches was a year, you know? So I had 1,000 matches in 3 years, basically, you know, and most guys now don't even, you know, the indie guys who've been doing 10 years don't have 1,000 matches. I mean, which, not to denigrate them, but it just, that's how lucky I was. And same with you. I mean, you got right away into Texas and they were still running, I think, like 4 or 5 nights a week, right?
4 or 5 nights a week. And then 2 months after I started, I was right there in Tennessee. And so, you know, that's 6 shots a week. And if you get the other Saturday spot show, and then you could be working 7 nights a week. But man, working at least 6 days a week and seven like you, or sometimes a double shot, that went into WCW, because a lot of times you could work 8 matches in a week.
Yeah.
But just going back to the repetition, dude, that was the key.
Right.
If you ain't in the ring.
Well, but even more so is what I learned, and this is probably the hardest thing to learn, is to listen to the people. And I was able to distinguish when they're cheering, but they really mean, we've seen enough of you. Or they're cheering and they're going, we want more. Or they're cheering and they're going, we're cheering, but we're just cheering because we're supposed to cheer. Like, it's like aloha in Hawaiian means like 16 different things, but so does audience applause. It doesn't just mean, just because they're cheering doesn't mean they still want you to stay out there. And knowing how much they wanted, like, not to insult Canyon, because I love Canyon. He was a great guy, bless his soul. But Canyon would always milk everything, so he'd get every last drop out of the audience, and I'd be saying, man, we need to leave. He's like, no, they're still popping. I'm like, yeah, but they're not popping because they want us to stay. They're popping because they like us. We were over, but they don't want to be disrespectful. It's not they're popping because...
It's starting to turn into a courtesy pop.
Yeah, it's starting to turn into a courtesy pop, yeah.
Leave them wanting more.
Leave them wanting more, and it's the hardest thing to learn. I remember... I was talking, there was that guy, Bobby Hard to Watch Work Walker, or Bobby Hard Work Walker, what we call him, Bobby Hard to Watch Worker.
Is that the dude with the body?
Black guy.
No, I was thinking about Chris Walker.
Oh, he had, what a body.
Hell of a body.
Yeah.
He worked Tennessee a little bit. Jesus Christ, guys work about 4% body fat. Anyway, so talk about the
other
Walker.
I go to him, I said, after, I think it was him, and after a match, I go, didn't you listen to the crowd? Because obviously he didn't. And he's like, no, I try not to. I'm like, what? And I was just like, I can't help this guy. I mean, and I'd only been in the business like, 4 years at that point. But because of the 2 years in Portland, like, I knew, you know what I mean? I knew when enough was enough, when it wasn't enough. Yeah, because I remember the first time, I was working out in Madrill. And so I was taking my robe off, bell rang. Because I always was smart. I always waited till the bell rang to work my gaga so it counted as time. And I'm working the gaga because, they tell you got 12 minutes or 15 minutes. You want that bell to ring right away as soon as you're in the ring, and then you can start playing with the crowd. And so I start taking off my robe, and the people start booing me. So I cover myself up, and I start to, sexily unveil it. They boo, I cover up. So I did like 13 minutes of that, right? Not knowing that that's way too much.
Right.
And then this is the rest of the match. The rest of the match, I remember this like yesterday. Al attacked me from behind in about 13 minutes, shot me into the turnbuckle. I moved and schoolboy. He charged me. I moved and schoolboy to 1-2-3. That was the match.
And the thing about it is back in the day, you could get away with stuff like that. And sometimes when I watch some of my old stuff off those TV tapings in Georgia, and a lot of those were center stage. You were there, Anderson, South Carolina, Dalton, all those little towns. Dude, there'd be so much gaga or laying in rear chin locks for so long. It'd be like, sometimes when I watch my old stuff back, I'm like, well, first of all, that was doable for that era.
Mm.
It doesn't translate today.
No.
You can't do that.
But it's also, they didn't work a chin lock. They just sat in a chin lock.
Oh, and I was laying in chin lock. I'm guilty.
Right. No, I'm not saying you. I'm saying, but that's also what ushered in a new era, because people... there's one thing to work a chin lock and crank it and you bring the guy down, up, whatever. But if you just sit in a chin lock, that's...
Yeah, but with respect to television
and
matches, it's almost... I don't know that you don't watch anymore, but I mean, the pace is pretty rapid now, and I'm accepting of the pace.
Right.
But back in the day when I was, kind of in those early 90 years, I was laying around a little too much.
Right.
Just
really? You think?
Sometimes.
I always thought you kept a pretty strong pace, like just right at the edge of if you would have gone too much faster, I would, you would have been a little, but I always felt you were right at the edge, perfectly.
Man, here's a guy that I always thought worked a little bit fast, and it was also part of his gimmick to work for him, but I also thought it could have worked against him as well, was Chris Benoit.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Phenomenal worker.
But
whatever happened at the end of his life, that was terrible. But in the ring, awesome.
Yeah.
But just too fast.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, because I've always said that, and people look at me like, he's the greatest worker ever.
Hey, work great. Hey, now, dude, he's too fast.
Too fast. And when he was on offense, he couldn't slow it down at all because he was too uncomfortable stopping, milking a pose, hitting a pose. Like, ever see a guy, like, he'll hit a move and he'll raise his arms up like, yay me, but he's so self-conscious that halfway through the pose, before the audience can boo or cheer, he'll turn away.
Yep.
So that way, he doesn't, that way, if they didn't boo him or didn't cheer him, he doesn't have to feel the, you know, the self-conscious gaze. But that's the whole idea, is when you hit that pose, you got to stop. If they don't boo you, they don't cheer you, they don't do anything, you just stay there until they do, or you're not over.
Yeah, but just as far as he goes, man, I was like, man, psychology, everything was just spot on.
Yeah.
Execution, mannerisms, just, dude, he was legit.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you just slowed down to give those beats and pauses and let the people in on certain levels, I thought the dude would have had twice the run that he did, and he had a phenomenal run.
Well, that's like Dean Malenko. He was the heaviest small guy in the history of the business. Everything he did was too smooth. Like, he was the other way. Like, it was just too lip, 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 lip. And so it looked like a dance, not a fight. And also, they would move through so many chain wrestling things so fast that you couldn't digest them, as opposed to, it's like you need a beat, boom, something else, boom, duck under, go behind, boom, hold for just a half a second just before the counter, as opposed to just nonstop, like, you know, like a dance.
And Dean was a hell of a technician.
Oh, hell of a technician.
But yeah, it was too smooth, but then on...
Yeah, I don't mean to denigrate him. He's a great worker.
No. Yeah, Dean's awesome. But on the other side of that, sometimes when you get the dudes out there and they're trying to struggle through the lockups, and
you
really look like you're just cinching in the headlock and you're just straining.
Yeah.
It almost looked like you're going to blow up in a static, work hold. It's like, dude, that's too much on the other side.
Right, right.
That's why I go back to the Bobby Ricky style for me, which I thought was perfect. Or the Flair style even.
This made me think of, me and Marty Jannetty would ride together back in Memphis, and he goes, we'd start burying people because that's what the boys do. You know, like, not that we were burying Dean or Chris, but just, you know, like, we were talking about them. And Marty would always go, hey, get the booking sheet out. We don't want to leave anybody off.
We always booking the territory to ride up and around in cars.
Yeah. If I didn't have that 2 years of riding with the grappler, like, the 2 years in the ring wouldn't have been anywhere near as meaning to my, you know, to my learning. Because it's that riding in the car afterward, when they're explaining to you what you did wrong, why you did it wrong, how you can fix it, you know, until somebody throws a flag and it's like, that's enough wrestling talk.
Did you ever run down the road with Gary Young?
No, but Gary Young, I've earlier when we were talking Billy Joe Travis, I thought you were going to bring him up because I know he was like big in your career, right? Wasn't he?
Oh yeah, man. He had a Datsun or Nissan 280 ZX. And he had a shoot million miles on that car.
Wow.
And, man, I'd always ride shotgun with him when I was making the rides with him. And, God dang, you know, I'd watch his match.
What a worker.
Yeah, oh, yeah, I'd get down the road. We'd be, you know, drinking a 12-pack of beer. And, you know, Gary's from Arkansas, had an accent.
Right.
Similar to mine, but different from mine. And, well, kid. And I said, man, why did you do this when you did it? Or how or what? And, man, he'd sit there and just break it down to me and just, like, straight up 101 fashion.
Right.
And it's like, you know, all the little pieces. And dude, when you're that young in your career, it's like, you know, a few years in, you're like, oh, yeah, that's stupid. I should have got that right off the bat. But, dude, when you're right in the middle of it trying to learn it, it ain't as easy as it looks.
Or sometimes.
And he really broke it down on a really easy level for me to pick up.
Yeah. And sometimes they'll tell you, and it still don't make any sense, as simple as it is. And you're like, I don't get it. And they're like, I'll be like, I used to ask Al Madrill, because Al Madrill was a hell of a worker. Yep. He was in Portland. And I'd go, he'd say, you need to do this, kid. And I'd go, well, why? Not meaning like, I'm not questioning, like saying, why, you know, why do you do that? Like, you're an idiot. You know, I'm questioning him like, why? So I know when it's appropriate and when it's not. And he's like, shut up, kid. You do it because I told you to. You know, but it was weird because you could only pilfer the information so much before they would think you're quite, before they're like, if you questioned the why, they would get offended, like you're questioning their, you know, the answers. But
sometimes, to me, if you're talking to a group of guys and they're all in business, say you're talking 15 guys, and some of them have been in the business for 7, 8, 9 years, and you got 1, 2, and you're 3, 4, 5 guys. So if you're telling them stuff, some of the guys are going to pick up what you're saying because they're at a level that they can understand.
Sure.
The people that aren't at that level yet, who haven't gained enough just base knowledge,
yeah,
they'll look at you like you're crazy. And they'll be nodding their head, okay, and they're like, I don't get it.
Right.
Because you're just not ready to absorb the information yet. You're not at that level.
Yeah. I remember Mike Graham when I was working in Florida Championship Wrestling.
Man, Mike Graham, came from the past.
Yeah, I mean, I
got along good with the guy until he cussed me out one time after a pay-per-view with Johnny B. Bad. Anyway, instrumental in my career. Continue.
So I was in Memphis for 3 months. I went to Florida. I wanted to, believe it or not, I actually used to do a plancha over the top rope to the floor. And
not well.
I mean, like the Ted Petty used to say, he goes, yours looks more realistic because it's so sloppy. So I wanted to do it. And Mike Graham goes, why don't you save it and make it a meaning spot? And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, well, what does he know? Hey, old timer. He just doesn't want me doing a cool move. I had no idea what he's talking about. A year later, I'm wrestling. And I was working a grappler The grappler, I think I turned babyface, and we had a pull apart. And I go to the grappler, I go, listen, have them pull you out of the ring and the pull apart. I'll break free and I'll dive over the top on you. So it looks like I'm really,
high. Now it means something.
And I'm like, oh my God, now I know what Mike Graham meant 2 years ago.
Yeah. How'd you get along with Mike Graham?
Usually pretty well, most of the time pretty well, but he was, I don't know. I irritate a lot of people. So, I was a different person.
You're so hard on yourself.
Well,
you did used to. Though.
Yeah, I did.
But Mike Graham was interesting down there in WCW. They brought him in, and I go down there, and of course, I'm 6'2", 250, and pretty jacked.
Right.
Coming still off my football days, young kid, long blonde hair, and all of a sudden I'm gonna.
But what do you weigh now?
242.
Yeah, you're still huge. It's really annoying.
Oh, no, I lost a lot of weight, so I was about 270. So
I know, but I'm saying, but you're still jacked, and it's really pissing me off.
I'm trying to hang in there. As our buddy would say, DDP, I'm trying to fight back the hands of time. I'm not doing a whole lot of yoga, though. But Mike Graham, I went down to WCW, and all of a sudden, he's one of the agents, but he's like a player coach.
Sure, sure.
He's running a show, but sometimes he'll work matches as well. I'm thinking, okay, Steve, I'm going to get there in the ring with you and work. I'm thinking, dude, man, you're 5'10", about $185.
Right.
His deal was he didn't have a great body, but his dad owned the territory, really smart, but he was a bench press guy, right? And Mike could work his ass off.
Yeah.
Great psychology. So anyway, I'm thinking all jacked up, the ego.
Right.
Green as grass, trying to learn the business. I'm going to work with this guy.
Yeah.
Dude, we went out there. He's calling a match. And all of a sudden, the lights went off in my brain.
Sure.
And I said, holy smokes, this guy's good.
Right.
I had a lot of fun with that guy and learned a lot from him. And his dad was an absolute mastermind.
Yeah.
So he helped me out a whole lot.
Did you ever see the finish? It was one of their big finishes. They used him and Kern as a tag team where somehow I forget what's going on. Oh, yeah. I guess Mike's getting beat down. They shoot Mike off. Then the heel would backdrop Mike. And Steve Kern would come in underneath while he's flying. My Mike's flying over his head. He'd come in from behind and give him the rolling reverse.
Yep.
What a finish.
Yeah. Mike, one of the things I really liked about what he did was the way he took a tackle.
Yeah.
He would, instead of taking the flat back off a tackle, I got a good Billy Joe Travis story that involves the tackle. But the way Mike would take a tackle, he was a smaller guy. So, you'd meet, give or take, around mid-ring or by the ropes for the tackle, go into a drop down or whatever that next high spot was. But he'd take that roll and bump.
Right, I remember.
He'd take it, roll through, and then go back into whatever the sequence was.
Right.
And I just thought, man, that's so smart because it's very realistic. And now you don't want everybody on the roster doing it.
Or
doing it. But he had a very unique way of doing it that made it look, I use the word organic, but it made it look like a shoot.
That's organic.
How it always happened because it has always got to be a flat back bump.
No, organic's the perfect word. The grappler had it. He would take a tackle and he would take it and like Bobby Eaton would, and he'd go where he'd slide facing you as opposed to perpendicular to you, and he'd slide facing you, and then he'd be right back up, either, whether you went to the next rope or stayed at the same rope. But it was so fluid, but it looked legit, but it was like, it looked so perfect. I mean, it was crazy.
One time I was working with, here's my Billy Joe Travis tackle story. I'm working in Dallas Sportatorium. Me and Billy Joe Travis, it could have been anywhere in Tennessee. I was working that territory, but I was working Billy Joe Travis. He's a heel. I'm the white meat babyface.
Sure.
Long hair. Dumber than a rock.
Yeah.
Green as grass. He's
stiff
got a headlock
as, stiff
on
as a
me.
Board.
Yeah, stiff as a board. He's got a headlock on me. We're in the middle of the ring. All right. You know, Billy.
Yeah.
Tackle, drop down, and hip toss, get it again. No, tackle, drop down, hip toss, and then that was in the
right,
hot spot.
Right.
So, okay, I'm thinking, okay, here's Billy Joe. He's got a headlock on me, so I'm going to send him in.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to give me the tackle. I'm going to drop down, and then when I come back up and he hits the ropes, I'm going to hip toss him, right?
Right. Yeah, of course.
Tackle, drop down, hip toss.
I see this coming.
Easy.
I see this play developing.
So all of a sudden, I send Billy off. He comes ricocheting off those ropes, and he's hitting me right there in the shoulder, chest to chest in the middle of the ring. And I'm thinking, okay, that dude's about 5'11", 205, 210.
Right.
I'm 250. Certainly he's going to go down for the tackle.
Right.
Well,
right.
Dude, when you're calling that spot, the yeah. guy in motion is the guy giving a tackle.
Of course.
The guy in the middle is the guy taking a tackle.
Of course.
I was the guy in the middle. So what did we do or what did I do? I did jabroni. Don't do this ever in a match. I'm going to a Dallas Page story after this. So we hit in the middle. There's that static pause.
Right.
He's standing there. I'm standing there.
Time stops. Time stops. And all of a sudden, you're like, I'm a freaking idiot.
I realize that I'm the guy that's supposed to
yeah,
take the tackle.
Course.
So 3 seconds later, I take a bump.
No. It's awesome.
So then he proceeds to hit the ropes. I do the drop down because,
right.
you know, I'm a rocket scientist. I got right. the high spot. But I didn't remember the hip toss, so I stayed on the ground.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I did. I promise.
That's awesome.
And so when he jumped over me for the drop down, he came back. I'm still laying there in the middle of the ring. So he started putting the boots to me. I'm supposed to hip toss him, tackle, drop down,
that's
hip
right.
toss him, and probably grab a headlock and take him over. But I was so damn stupid.
Sure.
That's how simple, I mean, the business can be, but that's how complex you can be when you're that young in a business. I was stupid as frick.
I love when you get two green guys and a guy will say, tackle, drop down, leapfrog, something. Doesn't matter what else. Here comes the leapfrog. Both guys think the other guy's leapfrogging. They both bend down and run into each other.
Yeah,
it's so
double,
awesome.
That of the double drive-by.
Yeah.
Or I also like when a guy's throwing a clothesline or the guy ducks, whatever it is. It's just a discombobulation. What was that other story I said I was going to tell you?
DDP.
Oh, DDP. I think it was the match. Who was he working with? I think it was the tuxedo. Oh, it was him and Big Scott Hall before he was Razor. And it was a deal where, you know, like you're supposed to get clotheslined over the top rope.
Right, right.
Dude, sometimes if you aren't up high enough, you
sure.
can't get over that rope because the axis is too high.
Right.
Rather than be down at the waist. So you learn.
Yeah, that. People don't understand that the mechanics that you have to get enough of your body at the top of the rope to go over with it.
And enough force to
and
get
enough,
you
and
over.
Enough force to get over.
So, but the other cardinal rule that you don't do, if someone gives you a clothesline over the top rope and you don't make it, you don't throw
yourself over the top rope.
And so sure enough, I think Scott comes to give Dallas, and me and Dallas have laughed about this a million times. And so Dallas doesn't make, Mick Foley was the guy that used to ride him real hard about this. Doesn't make it the first time. So sure enough, what does he do? There's nobody within 5 feet of him, and he throws himself over the top rope, takes a bump, and the crowd's at a frenzy. And then when that happens, it's like, oh, really?
Right. Me and Scotty Too Hottie had a match, like, on an indie show, like, I don't know, 10 years ago maybe. And, like, you'd think at this point in our careers, like, that we wouldn't, you know, screw up, like, you know, jabroni stupid stuff. But somehow we did like a tackle drop down, duck this clothesline, something. And I don't know whose fault it was, but I went for the clothesline and he ran by the other arm.
Yeah.
And we just, after the match, we're like, we got 40 years between us and we can't even run a stupid spot.
That's kind of similar to what I was thinking. You know, throw the clothesline one side and the guy's dipped down and he runs on the other side.
That runs to the other side.
Oh, man. The high spot. Do you think the way it's evolved, you know, business is work, but you know, back in the day, you know, like a typical building that you've been in, I've been in, with opposite dressing rooms at the opposite sides of the building, you never
right.
get a chance to see each other.
No.
Nashville Fairgrounds.
And it wasn't until somebody's like 10 years later, like, or like 70 years later from the start of business, that goes, hey, why don't we have a tape recorder and put some spots on it and pass it to the other side?
I never have been in the locker room that did that.
No, yeah. And I guess in Memphis, like when you're in Nashville, after a while, somebody finally smart. It's like the guy who figured out to put wheels on luggage. Like, how obviously, like, it's so obvious, but, man, do you remember luggage when no wheels? It was brutal.
Dude, I do. Well, see, here's the thing. If the guy was here, I'd like to shake his hand and give him a hug for inventing the wheels on the bottom of a suitcase.
Yes.
By the same token, I'd like to kick him in his ass and ask him why he didn't invent it 10 years earlier so I could have used it.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, the old time, remember Dusty, because he was such an old-timer, never had a wheeled bag, always had the bag over his shoulder, and he had, like, a lambskin thing pad that went over his shoulder where the strap was. And I always respected that because, man, I hate carrying luggage. Luggage is a nightmare. But I always thought, like, that's cool, man. Old timer, you know, he's still carrying the old school way, you know, with the luggage over the shoulder.
We're back to the high spot, the evolution of the high spot. What's the earliest wrestling you remember watching?
70s when I was a kid.
And that was pretty slow stuff back then. Well,
yeah.
It depends. I mean, because, Jesus, Nick Bockwinkel was doing good stuff.
Right,
Ray Stevens. But just the way the business has evolved.
Well, I think the drop, I thought about this one day. Where did the drop down come from? And I guess it came from the guy falling down, like not falling down, but going down and rolling at you to try and take
like
your legs out.
Like a knee block.
Yeah, to take your legs out. And somebody goes, hey, why don't I step over that?
Yeah.
And next thing, you know, so that went for a while. And I think that's how they developed. You know, it's like one guy goes, hey, man, I bet like the first guy to hit the ropes was like, I wonder if I hit the ropes and I come off and maybe the guy, I can do whatever, I can do something to him. And then that went on for a year. And then somebody goes, well, what if I tried to take his legs out? And that went on for 10 years. And then somebody goes, why don't I jump over him? And I bet it just developed bits and pieces, I guess.
When I think about jiu-jitsu, because I'm a big UFC fan.
Right, me too.
How everybody has got to have a jiu-jitsu background. You got to have a wrestling background. That really helps.
Oh, and this Saturday, man, what a card.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to be watching.
Yeah, I can't wait.
So I always figure when I'm watching two badasses, and Joe Rogan's really good at calling it.
Amazing.
Yeah, so I'm sitting there listening to everything Joe's saying, and now I can kind of put some pieces together. I don't know nothing about jiu-jitsu.
Right.
But I'm thinking, okay, who were the two dudes that just sequestered themselves in like a dojo and started inventing all this stuff?
Yeah.
Because it's so high level. And then I look at the business of pro wrestling. It's just like you and me are sitting across from each other at a 4x4 table talking about the evolution of the high spot. Yeah, okay, tackle here. You know, 6 months
I think
down
the table. I think the table's 3x3.
What, 3x3?
Three and a half by three and a half.
It's 40x40. I got a tape measure.
Did you really?
No, but I mean, just the evolution of the high spot of tackle. Okay,
right.
You know, drop down. It's kind of you're blocking the guy's knees and the guy jumps over you.
Right.
And then, okay.
So you think Helio Gracie was going to his brother Carlson? He goes, if I grab you and I pull this and something, I mean, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. I never thought about it like that.
Well, I'm just like, and then you have, like, what's it called? International? What's the international spot? It's like a tackle drop down hip toss. Get it again?
Heard international spot.
Really?
Hmm.
Dude, that's like the spot, and I don't even know it either. I mean, you and me got 60 years between us in the business.
I know what
one of us knows what the international is.
I know what the 1-2 is, which nobody does anymore. 1-2 is the heel punches the baby face, punches him back.
Yeah.
So that was the 1-2.
Yeah.
But you never heard that term anymore. Or the old sabi-da.
Sabi-de?
Sabi-da.
What's next?
Oh, wait, he goes, here we go. We should do Howard Cosell in present. Here we go, sabi-da. Here we go, sabi-de.
Man, that's a good way to end this podcast. You got time to stick around for another one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, man, let's talk about your podcast before we ride off of Sunset and kick it back up. The Raven Effect drops every single Monday on the Jericho Network at Podcast One.
Yeah, please tune in. And if you do, if you like it, subscribe, leave 5-star reviews. And you can even leave uncomplimentary comments, but just leave the 5 stars. So if you think it sucks, but this thing sucks, but put 5 stars and just, you know, humor me.
Yeah, we can work with you. Help us out. Hey, good talking to you.
Howdy, folks. It's good old JR Jim Ross, WWE Hall of Famer and barbecue enthusiast, here to tell you about my podcast, The Ross Report. It's right here on Podcast One each and every week. We're talking to all the folks that make it happen. The big newsmakers, opinion, stories, everything, the latest in pro wrestling, MMA, a little football coming up, and more right here on Podcast One. You know, recently we've had such guests as Stone Cold Steve Austin, the irrepressible Jim Cornette, Rey Mysterio, and even Bill Goldberg have been here. Download and listen to the Ross Report every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com, the brand new Podcast One app, and be sure and rate and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts.
Guys, before we wrap this show up, let me get you up on a new TV show you got to add to your DVRs. Mondays, the CW brings you to the front line of drama with the new military series, Valor. Two Special Ops Army helicopter pilots breaking boundaries and defying all expectations. Their bravery in the face of impossible odds earned them the Distinguished Flying Cross for Valor. But together, they're finding that truth is the first casualty of war. During their last mission, something went wrong. Something no one is talking about. So now they have secrets, but they're also patriots and refuse to leave any man behind. What would you do if you had to break the rules to do what's right? Would you stay grounded and step in line, or go to any lengths to learn the truth? They share secrets, go on clandestine missions, risk life and limb with only each other to depend on. How close would you get to the only person who really knows you? It's the explosive new drama that pushes the boundaries between military discipline and human nature. The new series that's right on target. Valor. New episodes on Mondays at 9, 8 Central after Supergirl, only on the CW.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
All right, everybody, give me to go home. Q's going to wrap up his podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do that, I want to thank my guest, Scott Levy, the Raven. He came by. We opened up a can of audio whoop ass today on today's podcast. I got another episode coming up with him real soon. Make sure you check out his show. It's under the Jericho Network at Podcast One, just like my show is at Podcast One. It's a free download on iTunes. Make sure you give it a listen. It was great seeing Scott and catching up with him. Hey, man, don't forget to set your DVRs this year. Broken Skull Challenge, Tuesdays, 10, 9 Central, only on CMT. And all the badass shirts I'm wearing on that show can be found at ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin. Every single shirt I wear this season is at that website. And I got some badass shirts this year. And this is a badass season. Make sure you set your DVRs. IPAs, I love them. You can find mine, Broken Skull IPA, at El Segundo Brewing Company. Here in California, we sell it to Whole Foods and Total Wines. And if you ain't in Cali, check inside the cellar.com and see if they ship to your state. And if you're looking to get either the Cold Steel Broken Skull Knife or the new Working Man's Knife, you can get them at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. I got to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. And you can find all my sponsors at podcastone.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. And speaking of Podcast One, the new Podcast One app is now available for download at the App Store or Google Play. There ain't another podcast app like this one anywhere, and that's because the new Podcast One app is loaded with some cool features that let you do a lot more than just listen to your favorite shows. You can access behind-the-scenes photos, articles, and connect with other fans of the shows you like. And you can watch over 1,000 360 virtual reality videos. You can actually watch some of your favorite shows in virtual reality. It's like you're sitting right in the room with them. So get to the App Store, Google Play, and download the new Podcast One app now. Folks, if you want to follow me on social media or Instagram, you can find me at Steve Austin BSR. Until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.